A lot of people think that Hollywood is a free place, but Hollywood is strictly defined by, on one side, the business, and the other side is ideology.
Цензура в Голливуде гораздо более мощная, чем в Советском Союзе. Вот это никто не понимает.
Hollywood is both a place and an idea. So you've got the movie studios, you've got television, you've got the music industry. Sometimes, as we know, it's also a place where there's a lot of propaganda.
So whatever policy the US government is committed to, you can be sure that Hollywood will be following it within 12 months.
How would I define Hollywood? Did they call it the dream manufacturer, which I think is true? But I think equally it's a propaganda factory.
Long after I first heard about it in the news, I still couldn't believe this. Was this really how the United States sees the history of World War II? But there it was, the official White House page on a social network, and it clearly stated that it was American Great Britain that defeated the Nazis during the Second World War, without even a word about the Soviet Union. And the version on the official Pentagon website looks even more discouraging. There, it turns out, that World War II was started by Germany and the Soviet Union. It wasn't Russia, but France that took the brunt of it. And in fact, the USSR didn't liberate Europe from Hitler, but occupied it. It feels like the author either knows nothing about history, or he does and wants to rewrite it. All that makes those old Hollywood movies that were made during the war seem even more remarkable. American audience was presented with a totally different picture of the world and the Soviet Union back then. In the next 30 minutes, we will learn how history has been written and rewritten through American cinema.
In 1943, at the height of World War II, the United States released Mission to Moscow, a film about a visit to the USSR by American Ambassador Joseph Davis, who was played by actor Walter Huston.
Major Kamenev, Your Excellency. May I welcome you to the Soviet Union in the name of my government.
Thank you, Major. My
wife? The US ambassador arrives in the USSR harboring a degree of skepticism, but on the whole, what he sees there and what millions of American moviegoers saw along with him breaks all the stereotypes about the Soviet government of those times.
We keep experimenting to find ways to increase our efficiency.
Well, what kind of a tractor is this? It looks different than the rest.
Yes, Mr. Davies. The reason is this. It can easily be converted.
The American film might even make the USSR look better than Soviet propaganda pictures. We see modern army, working factories, and friendly people who speak fluent English.
Oh, how proud I'd be if I could do that well with Russian. Perhaps someday we shall all speak the same language.
If a Hollywood producer even flirted with the idea of making a film like this, they'd probably be branded as crazy. But it was still possible back in the 1940s. This is one of my favorite parts. An aide tells the American ambassador, Mr. Davis, we need to check your office. And this is what the high-ranking American diplomat tells him.
And stop gossiping and stop listening to it. We're here in a sense as guests of the Soviet government. And I'm going to believe that they trust the United States as a friend until they prove otherwise.
Amazing.
In fact, the film is semi-documentary and was based on a book written by Ambassador Davis himself. So we're not talking about a fictional diplomat here, but a very real one. He was so impressed with the Soviet government that it seems he was ready to forgive a lie.
Больше всего шокирует образ Иосифа Виссарионовича Сталина, который там предстает. Такой добрый дедушка, старевичок-боровичок. Вот у него такие добрые глаза. Он у него такой мягкий и ласковый голос. Манеры такие прекрасные. И там он представлен как сам настоящий друг всех людей планеты Земля.
I believe, sir, that history will record you as a great builder for the benefit of mankind.
It is not my achievement, Mr. Davies. Our five-year plans were conceived by Lenin and carried out by the people themselves.
Again, this is Hollywood. This isn't Soviet propaganda.
The movie itself basically whitewashes the purge trials that were taking place in the Soviet Union. It's really an apologia for the Stalinist government. But that was acceptable in 1943. You could do that.
Another Hollywood film from the time, The North Star, depicts life at a Soviet collective farm on the eve of the war. The American audience doesn't hear a word about collectivization or the dispossession of independent farmers. The Soviet peasants look well-fed and are so happy they sing at the end of their workday. Chari-bari, rastabari, chari-bari. The filmmakers even went to the trouble of translating the lyrics of a famous Soviet song, White is My Motherland, and made American children learn it by heart. The North Star was produced by Samuel Goldwyn, co-founder of one of Hollywood's most successful film companies, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. But to understand why a famous American producer shot such a blatantly propagandistic picture, we need to go to the archives of the Library of Congress, where a document from the so-called Office of War Information of the United States is still stored.
The Office of War Information was established in 1942 by the Roosevelt administration, and it was basically a propaganda effort.
Сложность состояла в том, что американцы, конечно, в войну ввязываться не хотели. Для них эта европейская история была где-то далеко.
Franklin Roosevelt knew that if he wanted to actually turn American public opinion into supporting the war, and even more so in supporting our Soviet allies during the war, he was going to need to use Hollywood.
И возглавил этот офис журналист Элмер Дэвис, который как раз и сказал ключевую фразу о том, что самый простой способ донести пропаганду до зрителя – это через развлечения, то есть через художественные фильмы.
Sometimes the Office of War Information commissioned Hollywood musical comedies like This Is the Army, which were intended to increase the prestige of military service and raise the morale of soldiers fighting overseas. One of the roles in that film was played by a young actor named Ronald Reagan, the future president of the United States.
I've missed you too, plenty.
Thanks.
Eileen, there's something I'd like to explain.
About our marriage?
Yes.
There were other orders that weren't so benevolent. In 1942, after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt ordered the forced relocation of 120,000 Japanese people from the west coast of the United States. It's hard to believe, but in those years, Japanese Americans were simply put in buses and sent to specially created internment camps in U.S. territory. The Office of War Information was tasked with providing media to support this monstrous initiative.
Japanese fishermen had every opportunity to watch the movement of our ships. Japanese farmers were living close to vital aircraft plants.
This propaganda that the Japanese really are going to be act on behalf of the Japanese government and spies and sabotage the war effort and put arsenic in American food and blow up the defense facility. There was none of that. But the Office of War Information produced various documentaries defending this practice.
But the office issued very different instructions concerning the USSR. The Soviet Union was to be portrayed as a friend of America in distress. In the North Star, the Soviet peasants' peaceful life is interrupted by the Nazi invasion. After the Germans capture the village, they begin taking the children's blood for transfusions for their wounded soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
The North Star was nominated for 6 Academy Awards in 1944, and according to declassified documents, the Office of War Information commended its contribution to building a positive image of Russia.
In this presentation of the suffering and courage of the Russians, we are shown that the strength of Russia lies in its people, who are willing to give their lives to keep their countrymen from fascist slavery and to ensure a free world for all men.
Nonetheless, the office did ask Hollywood to make a few edits to the script. First, to emphasize that the ideologies of the USSR and Germany were completely different, and this is why the conflict broke out. And secondly, to show through the young characters Tatiana and Demian that the US and Russia can work together when peace comes.
It was not an accurate portrayal by any stretch of the imagination. However, they did follow the dictates of Washington and churned out propaganda film after propaganda film, including some major Hollywood stars of the time.
Another pro-Soviet film released by Hollywood during the war years, called Days of Glory, tells the story of a detachment of Soviet partisans. The group's leader was played by budding Hollywood actor Gregory Peck. Gregory Peck was the Brad Pitt of the 1950s and 60s. He starred alongside Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holidays in 1953, and in 1962, Peck won an Oscar for his performance as Atticus Finch in the adaptation of the cult American novel To Kill a Mockingbird. But the sex symbol and A-list star was still an unknown actor back in the 1940s. His debut role in Hollywood was as a Soviet partisan leader named Vladimir.
Where is Sergei and Mikhail?
They died.
Oh.
Vladimir, supper will spoil.
Вас не удивляет, что в годы Второй мировой войны в Голливуде была снята целая серия, по сути, пропагандистских, просоветских картин?
Это была идеология. Идеология тогда Голливуда была просоветской.
We had to change American thinking about the Soviets, and we did so successfully.
It wasn't only Hollywood that participated in the campaign to improve the Soviet Union's image. Leading newspapers and magazines were also involved. Here, for example, is what the American media wrote about Vladimir Lenin in those years.
Вот у меня тут даже подчеркнуто, да, the greatest man of modern times, да, то есть величайший человек современности. Он спас 140 миллионов людей от брутальной и некомпетентной тирании. Вы можете себе представить вот подобное в современном, не знаю, там, New York Times.
And that was the sentiment during the war, that the Soviets were brave, heroic in resisting the Nazis. And so we downplayed the crimes of Stalin and the repressive aspects in all of American writing and propaganda during the war, including in the Hollywood films. That's going to change, of course, after the war, once the Cold War begins.
With the onset of the Cold War, the task became more difficult. Now they needed to find a way to explain to Americans that our Soviet friends were friends no more, and in fact, they were now enemies. They also had to imply that some of the things that had been shown about them previously were not entirely true.
Что вам сказать о Голливуде? Это приятный очень был город, где невозможно иметь друзей. Это замечательная погода, где можно бегать по океану. И когда я приехал туда, конечно, иллюзия была, что я попал именно туда, где я хочу быть.
Andrei Konchalovsky was the first Soviet filmmaker to leave for Hollywood before the collapse of the USSR. In 1989, he directed an action comedy starring Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell called Tango and Cash. By that time, he'd already realized that Hollywood wasn't the place he'd originally imagined.
Jesus!
So I have to say that the illusion that Голливуд дает возможность себя выразить чрезвычайно легкомысленно. Продюсер решает за тебя все. Как ты снимаешь, кого ты снимаешь.
Glad you could drop in.
Я помню, я снимал когда картину большую, вот эту «Танго и Кэш». Я помню, продюсер пришел, сказал, пойдем, я хочу с тобой поговорить. Я говорю, я снимаю. А он говорит, да не бойся, они без тебя все снимают. Идем, все будет нормально. В Голливуде режиссер может быть пятилетний мальчик, который только знает два слова «мотор» и «стоп».
Despite making a series of successful films in the U.S., including Tango and Cash, Runaway Train, and Maria's Lovers, Andrei Kончаловский decided to return to Russia in the early 90s, as he'd already become entirely disenchanted with the American film industry.
Я думаю, что в Голливуде могут иметь успех больше всего успешные рекламщики. Это люди, которые имеют талант, и которые сухо могут поставить свой талант на требования рынка.
Hollywood was so successful in portraying the Soviet Union in a positive light during World War II that the new U.S. president, Harry Truman, began to quickly regret it after the Nazi surrender.
Когда кончилась Вторая мировая война, когда мы победили в коалиции с Соединенными Штатами, у нас возникла своеобразная зеркальная ситуация. Наши же кинематографисты вместе с советской армией прошли через всю Европу и не могли не заразиться некоторыми позитивными моментами, которые существовали в европейской цивилизации. Американцы и американские кинематографисты были сильно заражены левыми идеями.
In the 1930s, the Communist Party in the United States was pretty strong. And I say that is a good thing. They were critical in fighting early fighters for civil rights in the United States.
Hollywood had attracted all these creative artists, writers, directors, producers, actors and actresses, and intellectuals were the ones who were most attracted to the communist ideal. And they wanted to see the Soviet Union as representing something better than the sordid materialism of American capitalism.
So in 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee bore down on Hollywood. It was this committee that introduced the so-called Hollywood Blacklist, which included people who should be excluded from working in the U.S. film industry due to their alleged political convictions.
The U.S. government had to affirmatively go after leftists in Hollywood and destroy their careers, make them testify in Congress, put people in jail, drive people into unemployment, sometimes into suicide. So, I mean, to get Hollywood back on board on the anti-Soviet train.
Among those given testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee, or to put it simply, ratting out their colleagues, was an actor named Ronald Reagan. The future U.S. president was already actively participating in civic life even in those days. The North Star, a film about Soviet collective farmers that was hailed by the Academy just a couple of years earlier, was now deemed enemy propaganda, and its screenplay writer, Lillian Hellman, was accused of being a communist sympathizer, a damning label in those years.
Suddenly, all of those films, those propaganda films that were made during World War II, were brought into question, and Hollywood got scared.
The North Star was eventually re-released under the name Armored Attack. In the new version, the title Comrade was removed, and narration comparing the Nazis to the Soviet soldiers who suppressed the Hungarian uprising in 1956 was added. Hollywood is considered to be an independent private sector of economy, a group of private companies, and yet it seems like the government finds ways to influence the movie-making industry, and I just can't wrap my head around how they actually pull this off.
By these publicity trials, these show trials, Stalin understood how to do that, Hitler understood how to do that. Well, the United States under Truman and Eisenhower also understood how to do that.
A drained and intimidated Hollywood begins to promote an entirely different image of the Soviet Union.
Let's be honest. Have we anything like it in Russia?
No.
No.
Can you imagine what the beds would be in a hotel like that?
Ninochka, a film that pokes fun at the behavior of Soviet bureaucrats abroad, was shot in 1939, but it turned out to be most useful with the onset of the Cold War.
Comrade waiter!
Ниночка комедия такая человеческая, я бы сказал, главную роль сыграла Грета Гарбо, тогда самая великая звезда Голливуда. Она сыграла советского посла, который попадает на Запад и влюбляется в американцев.
The Americans actively distributed and promoted Ninochka in post-war Europe, especially in Italy, where the Communist Party's position was strong. Though it's never stated in the film that communism and the USSR are bad, it went without saying.
Ниночка, она воспринималась как антисоветская, потому что советская бюрократка вела себя не по-советски, то есть позволяла себе влюбиться в американца и вообще предпочесть человеческую жизнь нормам коммунистической морали.
We have the high ideal, but they have the climate.
The Hollywood began producing a spate of anti-communist films during this time, all with the same propaganda images. Nobody ever is idealistic about anything. The women were either ugly or they were beautiful. If they were beautiful, they were nymphomaniacs. Now my students find them laughable. But at the time, they were taken seriously. Movies like I Was a Communist for the FBI, I Married a Communist, Red Moscow, Guilty of Treason, The Red Menace. This was a terrible time in America.
In 1954, the United States and Great Britain released an animated film called Animal Farm, which is based on a novel of the same name by George Orwell. Its production was sponsored by the CIA, which was very interested in the anti-Soviet subtext of the story, which is about a farm and the pigs who seized power there.
Comrades, I have made a terrible discovery. There are traitors among us.
But by the 60s and 70s, relations between the US and the USSR had already reached the point of detente, and this was immediately reflected in Hollywood pictures.
The Soviet Union was certainly not presented as a friend of the United States, but it wasn't presented as an enemy. So it was more like the United States and the Soviet Union could cooperate against the bad guys. If you look at the James Bond movies, that's a classic of that genre, where there would always be a Russian agent who would be to whom Bond and the CIA people would be wary, they'd be suspicious of him, but they could always cooperate against the real enemy that was Spectre.
Relations between the countries began to deteriorate again in the 80s after Ronald Reagan, who had been actively anti-communist even when he was a Hollywood actor, became president of the United States. Even legendary movie boxer Rocky Balboa, played by Sylvester Stallone, entered the fray by taking on the daunting, doped-up Soviet fighter Ivan Drago.
Андрей Сергеевич, вопрос про Сильвестра Сталлоне, с которым вам довелось вместе работать в фильме «Танго и Кэш» в 89 году. Сталлоне, который был режиссером и сценаристом этого фильма, он правда таким видел Советский Союз?
Да, конечно, нет. Ему вообще до лампочки. Надо сделать деньги, надо сделать коммерческую вещь. В коммерческой вещи кто злодей? Либо китайцы, либо русские.
Why do they follow the policies of the State Department or Pentagon? Well, they get a lot of money from the State Department and the Pentagon. The State Department and Pentagon have a lot of say in works of Hollywood.
Я знаю, что самая жесткая цензура в Голливуде – это Пентагон. А мне это говорил Коппола. Пентагон утверждает все фильмы, читает все фильмы, в которых есть военнослужащие или работники ЦРУ.
Meet the Parents with Ben Stiller. Funny movie. Love it, right? So you find out that De Niro was a CIA operative at one point. Ben Stiller goes into his lair in the basement, and he sees photos of De Niro with Clinton, with what looks like maybe a Bin Laden-type figure. Originally, Stiller found a CIA torture manual on De Niro's desk. The CIA itself reviewed the script and said, nah, you're not going to bring up CIA torture.
Do they watch every single movie that is about to be produced in Hollywood?
In any film that has any military hardware in it, an obvious example, Top Gun, you gotta ask for permission. You don't just walk on to the Air Force base and start flying jets around. So if you get their permission, they get the right to look at what you're saying about them.
The Office of War Information, which was responsible for propaganda during World War II, was officially closed in 1945. But the relationship that developed between Hollywood and the US government in those years seems to have grown only stronger since then. At different times, American rulers have needed different myths, including some that directly contradicted earlier ones, as in the case of Russia. But no matter how difficult the order, this factory has always dutifully delivered.
Hollywood had always been afraid of government censorship, so what they did was that they censored themselves.
They live in the fiction, and they lie on the daily basis. They lie, you know what is the worst than this lie? They believe in this lie.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. It wasn't created for propaganda purposes, but Hollywood certainly is now a real propaganda force in the world, probably the greatest propaganda force that's ever existed.